How's it going, Reef Keepers? Hope you guys are having a great start to your week. I actually need to begin this episode with an apology. I accidentally used the name Aquaforest in lieu of Reef Factory when I was discussing the company that stabbed a small gear house in the back to jump over and get in bed with BRS in the most recent episode, the one right before this. That was Reef Factory, not Aquaforest. I think I was conflating a couple of European entities because in the United States, we don't get exposure to European reefing brands to the extent that, you know, other areas of the world do. And I just, you know, conflated the two of them. So I apologize to Aquaforest for that. You guys did not do that. And I apologize to you guys just for, you know, I know it's a mix up. They happen. I'm human. But I'm always going to correct those things. I never want to mislead anybody. You know, I never want to, you know, make somebody believe something that, you know, makes them look ignorant or stupid if they repeat it later, or anything like that. So, there's a apology and correction for you to kick this one off. But, this episode, I'm actually recording it the very next day, right after I posted the, Bulk Reef Supply episode. And that's a pretty quick turnaround for me. Normally it's like at least a week in between, you know, longer content, like the podcast. But honestly, I got a little bit farther than I thought I would on some of my technology side preparation for the semester, and I bought myself a little bit of time. And as I was thinking about it, I do recall, you know, struggling to slot in time for content during the first like week or two of getting classes underway. Normally during the 9 months of the academic year, I have no problem cranking out content, you know, but right at the beginning, things do get a little bit hectic, just like any, you know, big new thing that happens in a job. Like the beginning of every semester is a big new thing for sure. And so students are all confused and need me a lot. I'm figuring out new systems and protocols and stuff like that and just getting my feet back under me. So in kind of, you know, in to brace a little bit for maybe, you know, having a couple weeks where I have to go without any longer form content, I was like, you know what, I'll take one more morning for myself and for the listeners and create a podcast episode, kind of to tide people over in case I can't get one out, you know, really quickly here in the next couple weeks. So here I am back at it. And because I did quickly turn around and decide to do another one, I normally think about the content that I'm walking into in a podcast episode for at least like 4, 5, 6, 7 days before I do that episode, sometimes a couple of weeks. And I like to really like marinate with that topic mentally. And I kind of carry it with me in my, you know, mental back pocket, so to speak. And I just, while I have time to think about it, I kind of focus on that. I ask people I trust, in the industry or just fellow reef keepers questions about their perceptions around it. And I kind of, you know, information gather before I jump headlong into things. And so I couldn't do that this time. And I mean, I could prattle about some topic, but I might miss something and be like, oh man, I wish I'd waited on that episode. So what I want to do for this episode is kind of talk about my system, what changes I've made on my tank, what some of my methodology is, what some of my, you know, maintenance is. And, you know, I hesitate to create content like that, longer form especially, because, you know, I don't necessarily like to make it about like me, right? Like that's some of the people that I really, whose content I really, really, really can't stand. Everything that they do is just wholly centered on them. They're never looking outward and wondering how various aspects of the industry or reefkeeping methodology or, you know, what have you impact others. They're just focused on them. And those people get lots of followers. I mean, I kind of sense that people who regularly listen to me don't listen to me for that, because I don't do very much of that, right? When you're in reef keeping and you want to produce content, it's kind of a weird thing, because you can only, it's not like most people can just travel around and look at other people's tanks and systems and stuff like that. They have the system or systems that are in their home right there with them. So the content's kind of inherently about you, because the lens that you're delivering that content through is this very personal lens of like the subject matter that you have access to, which is right in front of you in your home all the time. And that's why I don't disproportionately focus more on me than I need to, like some other influencers that I see out there. I try to take that lens and kind of point the telescope out into the broader hobby, so to speak, if that makes sense. But I'm going to kind of point it inward this time, and talk about, you know, what, I don't really know where to start. So, I guess let's start with major changes that I have made to my system. And in talking about those changes, I think that I'll be able to like inform about, you know, pieces of my methodology. So, my system, by the way, is a 110, it might be something like 112. I always say 110 gallon total reef, you know, volume system between the sump and the display. The display is 80 gallons, right on the nose. And it's a water box, Peninsula Marine X Peninsula 4822 or 21 or something. And it's been a great tank, been a really good system. It's exactly the size system that I think at this point in my life I can handle. And look, I said I was going to talk about changes, and now I'm just like veering right into methodology, but so it goes. I kind of think when it comes to tank size, it's important to select, and by the way, this is hard to do, because a lot of times you're buying a tank and not really understanding size, especially if you're a new reef keeper. Like, you know, a lot of the rhetoric in this hobby is very much still like, you should go as big as you can go the first time you get a tank. Trust me, I've been in this hobby 20 years. You should go huge, as big as you can. And I kind of think that, you know, has started to, that approach has begun to erode, because I don't think it's necessarily the best way for most people, I would say. It's the best way for a few. I don't think it's the best way for most. But that, nevertheless, that thought process still pervades corners of, like, especially like older school reef keepers and such. And people listen to them, and people who are looking into the hobby look at that and listen to them. And if you've saved up money, or you just have the money to spend, which would be awesome, and you're like, well, some of the most experienced, like, you know, old school guys that when I've been researching, I've been seeing these guys, you know, talk on YouTube or whatever, they all say you should go bigger, and people go bigger. The problem with going bigger, let's put money aside. If money's not really an object, the problem with going bigger is, unless you're planning for an aquarium service to come and maintenance your tank every week, the bigger you go, every 5 gallons, 10 gallons greater in size you go, the more weekly maintenance you are taking on if you want that tank to be successful long term. You just are. It just is the way it is. Like, take glass scraping alone, right? So, like, that's what I always default to, because it's like true manual labor that you have to go through every week. So I clean my glass. I'm militant, by the way, about like maintenance in general. Militant. And I firmly believe in more or less being pretty militant about your maintenance. Like, I've got I've got this app. Let me pick up my phone and look at what it's called. This app is called Aquarimate. Like, g'day, mate. Like, Aquarimate. All one word. And that app is the best. I've tried a few, like, scheduling apps that are, like, aquarium, you know, themed or whatever, or centric before. This is the best one I've ever found. And you can basically put into it, like, details on all of your gear. You can put... there's like parameter logs in there. So when you're testing, you can like track your tests. There's a calendar function that marries up to like your Google Calendar or your Apple Calendar. And you can schedule everything out. So I have like, I'm so crazy OCD about like making sure I hit everything on time and never skip maintenance that I literally have like replacing my lithium iron phosphate backup battery on there, which is like 10 years away. I literally have that scheduled out. So understand, like, I'm a crazy person when it comes to this kind of thing, but I have other stuff like, you know, every 3 months I dip my wave makers in citric acid and clean those. And, you know, I have everything timed out on my RODI so that I'm replacing like, you know, the carbon filtration and the, you know, the, what's it called? Membranes. And, you know, I'm every single component of everything, even like buying new heaters. Like I have backup heaters in case my primary heaters go down. Like I buy expensive, titanium heaters as the primary heating system. And those I replace every 5 years because they're quite expensive. I've never had one fail. They are from, in case you're wondering, Innovative Marine, their Helio system. I do 5 years on those. I just replaced them like this past year. Ran for 5 years. These things are great. And I basically replace like Eheim, like Jaeger, like glass heaters. I replace those like every 2 years if they're backup heaters that like basically never turn on. But I still replace them because they're still like a $25 heater. Like there's no way that thing just sitting in salt water is going to be, in to my mind, to have peace of mind, reliable for more than 2 years. I'm not risking it. I'm not risking, you know, some kind of corrosion occurring over the course of 2 years. I leave it in there for four. Finally, the day comes that a failure happens and it must turn on, and it turns on and shoots electricity through the water because it's been corroded out. Like, I'm not messing with that. So, you know, I basically use that app as like my custom like Bible of reef maintenance. And I'm just crazy about keeping up on it. I'm a wild man when it comes to that. I recommend, I mean, maybe not getting to my level with it, but I recommend like using some kind of calendar function to remind yourself to do that kind of thing. Mark, I forget his last name, Mark, like Jake and Mark on, like the Mark of Jake and Mark, formerly of Reef Therapy, was big on that. He used his digital calendar a lot to... And he mentioned it many times throughout the reef therapy stint that he had. And I totally subscribe to that. I think that's your phone's always in your pocket. It's always there. You know, have something digital that's going to remind you. You wake up and see the reminder. Oh, yeah. Today I have to, you know, replace the media in my GFO reactor. Like, have something, right? But to go back, I'm just meandering crazily right now. To go back to what I was saying about tank size, you have to size up your maintenance in accordance with tank size. And at like 80 gallons for the display, and most of it is, you know, most of your like labor intensive maintenance is generally like on a week to week basis going to be in the display. So 80 gallons for me, that is enough. By the time I get done, you know, scraping the algae off the back glass and cleaning the overflow grill and stirring the sand and blowing off the rock with wave makers and doing all the stuff that I do on Saturday morning to my 80-gallon display tank, I'm tapped. I'm like, that's enough. I can do other stuff like refilling supplements and mixing salt water and like, but like, there's a finite amount of time that you either can or are willing to stand on a stool or ladder or whatever in front of your tank, if you have a big tank, and stand, you know, at your tank and crank away with physical maintenance every week. There's just a limited time that you either can afford to give to it or that you're willing to give to it. And I think that people, unfortunately, the like curse of this is you really have to have been in the hobby for a while to understand or project what you think your like tank size limitation in that maintenance regard is going to be. So I had a 25-gallon tank before that. That was my, you know, primary tank. And I upgraded to this, you know, 110-gallon system, 80-gallon display. And I felt confident, like I could just knock that 25-gallon out so easily. I was very much considering doing a custom tank that was 5 feet long and 2 feet deep. I was very much considering that because it's kind of a non-traditional size. I don't see a lot of like, there are some 5 foot tanks offered, but normally you go jump from like 4 to 6. It was a little too much money for me to, I could have done it, but I really didn't want to bite that bullet. And then I really thought about it and it kind of, my decision to land on the 4 foot tank came down to maintenance. I was like, you know, jumping from, I know what it takes me and it's easy enough on this 25 gallon to get maintenance done. But if I go times 3 on that, and really it's more like times 4 because you're often adding, you know, glass dimensionality in multiple directions when you go up that big. I was like, I think I'm going to do this 80-gallon 4-footer. And that was the right call for me at this point in my life. After my kids, not little, like, I don't know how old, because this is the first time I've been a dad. Is, you know, I have one kid. It's probably all I'm ever going to have. But after she hits a point where she's more or less, you know, autopiloting on, like, you know, needing my assistance on a day-to-day basis, because I'm a pretty hands-on dad. Like, I really, you know, I really want to be there for my kid and, like, make sure that I'm not, you know, neglecting her in any way. So like I really go out of my way to spend time with her and do stuff with her and help her with stuff and participate in her life. So like after she gets to a point where she, that becomes not cool anymore for a while. And she's like, Dad, you're uncool. Get away from me. I'm cool. I'm good. Like at that point I will probably consider, okay, you know, if I could just truly spend half a day, just wake up at 8 a.m. and like spend until 2 p.m. just working on my tank and nobody's going to care. Nobody's going to care at all. Like it's going to be Saturday morning and everybody's doing their thing and I can do my thing and not have to deviate from my thing. Then, yeah, I think that like I think my in my dream world, my next move would be like a 7-foot tank. I think it'll probably like, you know, cooler heads will prevail and it will probably my wife's head and it'll probably be a 6-foot tank. I would go deep on it, by the way. Like if I'm going to do it, I would go 28, 30 inches deep. Maybe that sounds crazy, but I want depth now. I've had the relatively normal, you know, depth tank. And that's the only like area that I feel limitation in when I'm like adjusting rock work or placing corals and stuff. I'm like, oh man, if this was like a, you know, 3-4 inches deeper, this would be perfect. Like, I don't want to feel that limitation so much anymore. So that's probably in all reality, I'd probably, you know, either find some kind of rare beast of a tank, that is like that 28, 30 inches deep and like 6 feet, long, or I would just have one custom built to that length. But that's years away. I mean, I'm so content with the tank that I have now, especially given the constraints of my current world. It's all I can handle. And I think it's really important that people be honest with themselves about what they can handle. Like, what can you really bear? And not just like, you know, think about it in terms of like one weekend. Like, you got to think about it in terms of years and years and years. Like, if you really want to be in this hobby and you really want to go big with it, like, can you keep that up for years and years and years and years? That's an important consideration for sure. So my methodology really starts at, like, the most basic foundational level. And that's where it began, was, like, what can I handle? And, like, that's what I can handle for sure. And it's been great. So, let's see. Rock, I have totally shifted on rock. I guess I'll just go through my methodology. Maybe this episode will just become about my methodology. And I'll save, like, changes to the system for later episodes. We'll see how long I go. I got time. Rock in my tank. So I started this tank out. I have started, in fact, every tank that I have ever owned the following way. Marco premium, quote-unquote, live rock. It's not live. It's dry. Marco dry rock. I don't know why they call that live dry rock. That's such a ridiculous, confusing thing. They want to make you think, like, you know, oh, it's still going to be the same. That's what it is. It's marketing BS. It's dry rock. And I've done premium Marco dry rock with Fritz Turbo Start 900, which, who knows now, right? Like, bacteria in bottles, it's largely been found to basically be terrestrial bacillus. Bacillus being a cheap, easy to propagate bacteria that you can buy in sheets from China for nothing and then mark up 400% and sell to American reef keepers who don't understand the science and aren't going to do anything about it except buy more of it. So in light of so many bacterial products being exposed for what they are, which is like bacteria that there's really like no conclusive proof that it has some like great positive effect on your reef tank microbiome or coral, what I would do in the future is I'd go one of two ways. So I would not go like TBS live rock or you know, Tampa Bay saltwater live sand. I wouldn't do that on a system where I am going to like, it's going to be a main primary display system that I want to keep as beautiful as possible. One, of course, you have pests that can come in on stuff like that. Like, you know, whatever, like a, I don't know if bobbit worms occur down where TBS pulls their rock, but the thought process behind live rock is like you could get like a crab that eats coral or like a bobbit worm or something like that. There's that to worry about. I'm not so worried about that. I'm pretty good at dealing with pests at this point. What I'm more worried about is getting something like, and I probably butcher the name. Is it Uranema? There are other like, so there are fish diseases and pathogens that can affect coral that can come in on like quote unquote true live rock. So rock that's been dropped in the actual ocean and seeded. And like Remy, Bahama Llama Coral, at Reef Builders, Remy had that Uranema come in with live sand in his tank. There's no way to, I mean, it's just a wild card draw. Like you have no, by the way, it's probably not going to do anything to your fish, like or coral or microbiome, like probably. But if it did decide to run out of control and run rampant, like, Remy hasn't had any issues, but who's to say that that won't flare up at some point? There's a tank crash situation that happens out of nowhere. You know, his home city has no power for, you know, 10 days or something. And he somehow keeps the tank alive, but, like, the up and down of the system somehow allows some of these, you know, pathogenic things to proliferate. It's the risk factor that I don't want. So I wouldn't go for a primary display system with live rock. I'll tell you what I would put it in, and what I'm going to put it in is that 25-gallon tank I mentioned earlier, which is now my daughter's tank. That nano tank has been a disappointment in many ways. We set it up with dry rock and that Turbo Start again. And it just was never right. It was never, never right. And the coral, some, not all of them, some corals have thrived in that tank. I haven't really shown it much on YouTube because, honestly, like, it's just been so weird what's been thriving and what's been failing. And that system is a weird system. And what we're going to do to it is completely blow it out. All right. I already cleared this with her, by the way. She this is her tank. She makes the call. I gave her a couple different options, and she's like, I want to do this one. So we are going to order Tampa Bay Saltwater Live Rock just for the 25-gallon tank. We're going to get one of their little treasure chests with, like, 8 pounds of, like, actual, like, premium live rock with, like, sponges and macroalgae and stuff growing on it. And we're going to put that in that tank. And we're going to put it in there, I'm 95% sure, we're going to put it in there with a little puffer fish, like a Caribbean puffer fish. And she's at the age where, like, she looks at my 80-gallon display tank with just, like, awe and wonder. But what does she want? She wants a pet. She wants, you know, not a school of fish. She wants a fish to be her fish. So, like, I think puffers are cool. I've never had one. I'm reading up on them now, but I think that's what we're going to do. And that tank will be, like, you know, her little puffer tank. But what will be cooler about it, and what she's super excited for and I'm super excited for, is we're not going to do any additives to this system. We're not even going to put coral in it for, like, a long while. And if we do put coral in it, it's all going to be, like, Caribbean-based coral. What we're going to do is just let the live rock grow. Just keep the light on a you know, normal cycle over the tank and keep the flow going. You know, keep everything stable. But we're just going to see, like, what happens with, you know, ocean-seeded live rock in this tank. And I plan on, like, doing aquabiomics testing to see what happens over time and what the bacterial populations look like. And I think that'll be super fun, and I think that's a great application. You know, it's minimal risk to fish. There's going to be one fish. There's not really going to be any coral for, like, a good long while. There's a minimal amount of things that are at risk going this route. So I think that's the route we're gonna take. That's where I see right now, at least, and until we, you know, all the scientific minds in the hobby discover ways around, you know, pathogenic bad guys that you could put in your tank with live rock. That's the application I would use for live rock, I think. What I would do for starting a new system now, if I were to, like, break down my 80-gallon and restart it, I would look for a manufacturer who is willing to do an aquabiomics test on seeded live rock that they could sell me. So live rock that's, like, in a bacterial, you know, in a microbiome, in, like, you know, at some entity like saltwateraquarium.com or Champion Lighting and Supply, and has been tested to know that there are no significant pathogens that I could be putting in my tank, but you're still getting a broad, diverse microbiome from an established system. And you could do, by the way, you could do this with another hobbyist too. Like, if another hobbyist were willing to sell you some of their rock and do an A-B test, or do an A-B test and then put rock and seed it in their tank or in their sump for you for, like, 6 months, I think that's a totally viable way to go. I suppose you could also, like, do half and half. So you get, like, some dry rock, put it in there, and then seed that dry rock by doing the other half with, like, that established live rock that you've had a test run on and that you know is good. I know that sounds like a lot of work. I know that's, like, a lot of complexity, but that's the point that I'm at in the hobby. If/when I begin a new system, I mean, years from now I will for sure, for my primary system, that's what I would do. If I need this thing to, like, look good long term and it's going to be, like, the eye catcher, like the main piece, right? Like, that's what I would do. I think that's going to make your microbiome, like, the strongest over time. And when it comes to rock, this is all preference. I always arrange rock so that, like, there are some, like, pillar pieces down on the bottom. So like lumpy rock, and I kind of space them out. Then I get shelf rock and I put it on top of those lumps that are on the bottom to create like a shelf. And then I layer on top of that shelf. What that does is it creates caverns for your fish to sleep in, hide in, get away from each other in, feel safe in. It also encourages flow to go through there so that you don't get a ton of detritus buildup underneath your rock. It elevates everything, which I like. I like rockscape that's a little bit elevated. I don't like everything to just lay down low. And I also make sure that there is a swim lane around the entirety of the rock structure in the center. I want the fish to be able to go all the way around the outside, all the way around. That also encourages detritus getting moved by the wave makers out from behind rock on all sides, which is good. And that's kind of how I approach rock, and I don't glue any of it together. There's too many instances where I have found myself needing to, you know, adjust parts of the scape or like take something apart to get at a fish that's hiding or whatever, and gluing it together, to me, it's just like, no, get a bunch of shelf rock and find the pieces that kind of interlock with one another in a reasonable way. Press down on them on top after you set it to make sure it's not super wobbly. And as long as it's stable, I think that that's good. Like, I don't really subscribe to the whole, oh, let's make like artwork out of live rock, like spindly, you know, all of it, like, you know, put together with like ceramic rods and glue, and like, where are your fish going to hide, you know? And like, how much room do you really have for coral placement with that? Also, like, I don't know. I'd love to see testing done on this. I don't know if any formal testing has occurred on this, but if you're creating like a spindly artistic rock structure, I don't see, like, I mean, maybe there's enough room for bacterial colonization. I don't know bacteria on that level, but I feel like more live rock can never really hurt when it comes to your microbiome. I mean, it depends on the placement, I guess, but like, as long as you're placing it in a way that does not encourage a bunch of detritus buildup, I feel like more rock is probably always going to just create more real estate for bacterial colonization. So, you know, that's kind of how I approach rock, is like, you know, don't limit yourself and like try to go super, like don't try to reduce artificially how much rock goes into your system, or arbitrarily, I guess. You know, don't make that like a goal, unless your goal is like to create, you know, very artistic rock work. And then we're just not in the same camp. You know, we're just doing different things at that point. Sand, to move away from rock, so I quit ranting about rock. I believe in sand and reef tanks. I do. I believe in sand and reef tanks. I don't care what other people do. I mean, if you don't like sand, I don't care. I don't think that for me, like, what I want to see in my home, I don't think that looks good. I'll just be dead honest. I don't think that, I've seen tanks that are bare bottom that look good. And I'm like, wow, that's, you know, stunning Acropora. Like, that, you know, this is an amazing tank. I generally don't think that bare bottom tanks look as good. I'll say this. It's not that they look bad. I don't think they look as good as tanks with sand. And it doesn't need to be like some kind of, you know, Fiji pink fancy sand or anything like that. I just think, like, you know, some kind of, you know, media, even if it's fairly coarse. Like, I think I have fairly coarse, like, in the scope of sand. I think I used Carib C special grade, which is like, you know, sand that like a sand that a pistol shrimp can actually like manipulate. It doesn't just slip through their claws. They can push big groupings of sand around. It's medium. It's not coarse. It's not fine. It's like somewhere in the middle. But even coarser stuff, like, I just think something, like, there should be something. I think that I have to believe that it's more, I don't know why I believe this, but I feel like fish seem to like it. My fish are always bothering the sand and messing around in sand. And I mean, I have a wrasse that sleeps in the sand. Like, it broadens some of the things that you can do. It limits others. I understand that. My thing with sand is this. I don't believe in deep sand beds at all. And I think that there's this, like, and I don't know that it's a fallacy. It could be true, but it makes me nervous. So, like, there's this whole thing in the hobby where a contingent of people, when it comes to sand, are like, oh, yeah, you know, do a healthy sand bed, but don't ever disturb it. Ever. Don't ever disturb that sand, or it'll kill your tank. And, like, I don't know. I don't know, because when I heard that, I was like, well, I want sand, and I don't want to create a bomb of, like, you know, like a DOC bomb underneath my sand bed. So what do I do to combat this? And I just decided, what's one more thing on my maintenance schedule every week? Just do one more thing. I take a super long pair of tongs, and I rake thoroughly through all of the sand in the tank on all sides of my rockscape. And I have, you know, never had like anything show a negative reaction to this. There's not all that much that comes up out of the sand because I do it every single week. So I am disturbing the sand bed every week. And when I poured the sand flat in the tank, I poured it so that it was 3/4 of an inch all around. I did not want to go an inch or higher. And the sand is naturally going to group based on currents, based on creatures moving it, whatever. And the sand kind of groups to the sides. I notice the middle will thin out. I'll like rake it back every week. But it's kind of nice that it groups in areas like in the back. And I do not push the sand back level in the rear of the tank, because I want part of the tank to have a little bit of deeper sand for that wrasse to sleep in. And sure enough, that's where she sleeps. But I think don't overdo it on sand. Certainly don't go for like even a mid-range or deep sand bed. I would do like, you know, I don't know, a half inch to an inch of sand. And my personal experience, and I'm sure that there's some kind of experiment that could be run on it, and like I'd be proven right or wrong, like, and have some fallacy with this, but I think it's good to disturb the sand as long as you're going to truly do it every single week. Like, you got to keep doing it. And that's part of that methodology of having like a militant maintenance schedule. Disturb the sand. Do it weekly, again and again and again and again. And never allow that like DOC bomb to build up down underneath the sand. And don't cause your tank undue risk by skipping it. I will just not do that this month. I'll start again next month. Well, guess what? A DOC bomb's built up in that month. You have to stay on top of it, on top of really everything. But when it comes to sand, that's the one thing, like, I would, if I couldn't scrape the glass, something was going on that was, you know, stretching me thin, and I needed to put off maintenance for a few days, the one thing I would do is pop the lid and scrape and rake through the sand on Saturday and then put it back. You know, give me 5 minutes. I'm going to do this real quick. Boom, 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 done. And I'll worry about the rest of it later if there was an emergency. But I would, not an emergency, but, you know, something that was taking my time that day. I would definitely rake the sand. So I have to believe it's good. I'm also just finding it funny as I continue here that this has totally become about methodology. And I started out and I said, I'm going to talk about the changes that I made this summer. And then I immediately just averted course and went straight into methodology. So I guess I'll keep going until I can't talk anymore. Quite frankly, this is good for practice for my vocal cords, my throat, to talk like this for a while this week, because you really do go through an adjustment period where you kind of go hoarse after you have begun lecturing again when you start teaching. So this is good. Okay, so we've covered sand, rock, tank size, maintenance. Let's see. Flow, we could talk about. So like for me with flow, and I guess that's a change I've incorporated, so I can kind of talk about that a little bit. So I have one And flow is going to be different for people who don't have mixed reefs. If you just have, like, you know, if you're an acro heavy tank, you're just going to be, you know, going, you know, all out with flow. I get that. I think most people have a mixed reef. I've got a mixed reef. I have no softies in this tank. Well, I guess GSP softy, but GSP is kind of its own beast. It's its own category when it comes to husbandry. So it's like Xenia and GSP are just like wild. Those things are prolific. But I have hard coral SPS on the top of the scape, and I've got a bunch of, you know, thriving LPS in this tank. And I have one Acropora frag. It's kind of like dead center, slightly left. It's a cream colored. So this acro frag, so you guys will know if you follow my channel, I tried acros for a while, and I got acros from Tidal Gardens during one of their sales, and I don't know what happened. I feel like Tidal Gardens went through like a rough period, because I've bought corals from them before, and they were always packaged so nice. They were really, you know, high quality, no disease, nothing, you know, dipped them, put them in, had success. These corals literally came in like ice cold water. There was like one warm pack in there. They were all ice cold, and which made them, I think, probably weak. And they had just thrown them into bags. Like, these bags were, they were not in cups. They were not like suspended with rubber bands and stuff in a cup like you would expect with like a delicate Acropora. They were literally thrown into bags of water and then thrown haphazardly into a box and shipped to me. I don't know. I feel like that's not what Dan's about. I feel like whoever did that during that sale got fired or something, because I was astounded when I opened them that way. And then I was not astounded because, you know, these coral farms deal with this stuff, and it comes in from the wild. And what are they going to do? Sometimes stuff gets through. But my God, these things were infested with ostracods, a.k.a. seed shrimp, a.k.a. red bugs, gray bugs, whatever you want to call them. And it was during a point of low income for me. I could not get Interceptor at the time. I had a vet who was willing to talk to me about it, and I kept, you know, hoping that I would get enough money for the appointment, because it was an exotic veterinarian, and I just didn't get the money before they died. But honestly, like, I was so... Sometimes you're like so gung-ho for something that's hobby, and something happens and it just takes the wind out of your sails. And I got to be honest with you, like, the wind for Acropora got sucked out of my sails so hard, and I am like done with acros. So I did have the flow in this tank pretty elevated for like a long time, until really a few days ago. And I started to notice that my Elegance coral, which got pretty battered with this flow, was starting to just not look its best. And I was like, you know what? I'm pretty darn good at growing LPS, and I'm good with like normal SPS coral, like Montes, and, you know. And so, like, I think I'm going to just... There's one acro in this tank, and there's 20 other corals or 30 other corals or whatever. I think I'm just going to not care about that Acropora anymore, which sounds so bad, right? But it's like one versus the rest, right? Like, you know, it's like, what's the guy in Shrek, the evil king or whatever? And he's like, some of you may die, and that's a risk I'm willing to take. Like, that's how I feel here. Like, I really, to make the rest of the coral in the tank happier, I notched the flow down about 15%. And my gosh, they are so, everything is so much happier on a day-to-day basis because of this. That Elegance already looks better. The Montes up on top, the polyps are further out than I've ever seen them before. And so I'm keeping the flow here. So basically I have flow that oscillates between like, you know, on the low end of high, and from like, so from medium to like on the low end of the high spectrum. It never really gets high. It never really gets to a point where things are whipping around anymore. And I think that's good for like a standard mixed reef tank that's just got, you know, more ordinary SPS and like you know, general LPS. I think that that seems to be pretty good. That really keeps things moving well, but does not, like, crank on the corals unnecessarily, if that makes sense. And I kind of keep my powerheads, or my wave makers, elevated. Not everybody understands powerhead terminology, by the way. I always want to call them powerheads. Wave maker is easier for people. I've had people get confused about powerhead. So I try to say wave makers. But I have my wave makers elevated. And then I have them all angled slightly up so that right above the rockscape, the streams of the wave makers kind of meet. And I have them on maximum variance. So, like, my flow strength varies between, like, 40% and 60%. And they're all going at different intervals. So sometimes flow is stronger from one angle, sometimes another. And it creates super turbulent flow. Like, if you're watching on YouTube, you can see, watch my corals really intently for, like, a couple minutes. And you'll see that they're whipping one way, then the other way, then all over the place, then from another direction. That, you know, that's what... That turbulent reflow is what I'm looking for. I don't want flow to always be battering stronger from one direction. So also, when you have a mixed reef, logically you're going to have the SPS on top. So keeping the wave makers elevated means that most of that stronger flow is going to be happening up high. And you're getting residual flow in varying degrees of intensity as like a side product of that higher flow up top. Down low, like that residual flow is happening down low where the LPS is going to live, and the LPS don't need as high of flow as SPS, so it works out. It kind of, the way I've got it set up, I really am not looking to mess with it right now. I think everything looks exceedingly happy. Of course, things change all the time in reef keeping, but right now, like, you know, that's what's looking good for me right now. So lighting. To move on to another category, lighting, I believe that measurements that have been taken out on the reef, and again, I need to stress this, I am no expert at all when it comes to spectrum and PAR, and like, I'm just not. I have a Vibira PAR meter, which is like that $175, you know, Amazon PAR meter from China, and it works great. But I just need to know what the PAR is. I don't get into like the debates about PAR, and I don't really get into the debates about spectrum. My general belief on spectrum is that if you can get close, like you hear all these debates, oh, metal halide, oh, you know, T5, oh, you know, LED, you know, the spectrum on this LED is, you know, really weak in this color range, or this, you know, color range is way better for coral. And, you know, I'm like, okay, like, what does it look like on the reef? Like, I just go like as essential as possible with this. Like, what does the spectrum look like if you go out on the Great Barrier Reef and you took are they called a spectrometer? I'm just going to call it a spectrometer. If you took a spectrometer out there and you swam down to the top of the rock and you just set it there, what does that reading look like? And I'll tell you what, those readings look a lot different than most of the lights on the market. They look a lot different. And I'm sure that there's people out there who would be like, well, they look different for a reason, because we've figured out that, you know, these spectrums, you know, these certain colors on the spectrum are way better for coral, and they're not even using these other colors and blah, blah, blah. Like, okay, what does it look like on the reef? I want to emulate that as much as I can, while also being mindful of sending my dollars to lighting companies that are actually like fair and actually like, you know, they're transparent. They put out real data. They aren't jerking you around on price. Like, all, you know, they actually have a decent warranty and service, like all these different things. We have to marry our human world and our human consumerism with the science. Right. So the way that I went about it, I've got ReFi Uno 2.0 Pros, because I really believe ReFi is a unique bird. I really respect that company. And ReFi has a 3-year warranty to Ecotech Marines 1, for instance. If you want to talk about how much a company trusts their lights that they're putting out into the market. Yeah. for $480, you're getting a light that's stronger with a way better warranty than Ecotec offers. And I'm not talking about like just the XR15. It's stronger than the XR30 G6. So yeah, it's a great light for a $480 price point, less than half the price of a G6 XR30, and it's going to be stronger, right? So also the Spectrum is better. And I will say that the Spectrum is not the Spectrum is great with like blues, violets. It looks a lot like everything else as you taper down. And again, somebody might come out of the woodwork and be like, no, it doesn't. It looks, you know, to my eye, to my untrained eye, when I look at like a Spectrum, you know, sheet, like that's a Spectrum graph. That's what it looks like. It looks a lot like once you get away from blues and violets, it kind of ramps down into the same narrow band that so many other LED lights look like. However, I bolster that Spectrum by using Tropic Sun Spectrum Quanta Reef, Quanta Pros by Quanta Reef. So the Quanta Pro line was developed by a fella named Luca up in Wisconsin. And great guy, super into the hard data of everything, big data guy. And fantastic service. And Luca created basically he took the idea of like the black bar, you know, from China, AliExpress bar. And he was like, this is a great, you know, loose form factor. But how about like we actually look at the data behind it and actually look at the science behind it and generate spectrum based on, you know, all the different needs that people might have. So, by the way, he just launched the Quanta Helix, which is dimmable. So that's a notable difference from the Quanta Pro. I think he's still selling Quanta Pro. This is, the Quanta Pro doesn't have dimming function. It's just on off. But the quality of them is exceptionally high. They have and I might mess this word up, but I think, so it's a quad LED. So every node on there has like four LEDs that blend all different colors of the spectrum together to get you better blending on everything. And the Tropic Sun variety in particular, he's got like six different varieties that all have different spectrum ranges. The Tropic Sun is mimicking that full daylight spectrum. So it's really heavy on like reds, oranges, you know, greens, yellows, like, and so that to me fills in the blanks that you get down on that far end of the spectrum, you know, after the blues and violets fall away with the reef eyes. So the combination of these two lights, like, I can't afford a good spectrometer. Maybe if, you know, Telegram or another light guy listens to this episode, they can be like, oh, I have a $200 spectrometer that would be great for you. I might buy that in months to come because I'm getting more interested in spectrum. Right now, I'm no expert. But I have to imagine when I compare the spectrum graphs, I have to imagine that I'm getting a pretty healthy spread across the spectrum between these two lights that I've chosen. And I think that there's way, way, way too much of an obsession with, ooh, I want a black light party in my living room. And like, by the way, I know some of you guys are like, don't come at my black light party. You guys have said that to me before. And I'm sorry. Like, I know it looks cool. I'm not denying that the black light party looks cool. By the way, like, you know, in the hour or two before my lights shut off at night, my living room's a black light party and it's cool. I like to look at the black light party a little bit. That's not my like preference for most of the time. I like a really brightly lit tank, which is not typical for the United States. Like most Americans want to trend toward the black light party look. And I get it. You know, again, it's cool. But in Europe, their tanks are brighter, I guess I've heard. And I think I've seen that evidence of that based on watching videos from across the sea. But I immediately kind of was aligned with that appearance to my tank. I wanted to really see all the detail and pop of the fish. And I wanted more of a daylight spectrum so I could see, like, what would this coral look like if I was, like, shallow reef diving? And again, I've said this on prior episodes. I know that, like, our tanks, it's very hard to replicate the look of the actual reef when it comes to lighting. I just wanted more daylight-themed lighting. So, my methodology kind of, you know, using my methodology on spectrum to seek a better spectrum on lighting, or a broader spectrum on lighting, kind of jived with my aesthetic preferences, and I was pretty happy with that. And the combination of these two things, these two lights, is my happy place. I really, really, really enjoy it. What I would encourage people to do, if they ask me, if they come to me and they're like, I have no real aesthetic preference, I want to, like, you know, what's the best thing? What would you advise? I'd first tell them that I was ill-equipped to advise on this, but I would say, you know, readings from the actual reef show a pretty healthy, you know, pretty healthy colors across the board. So I would turn up your color channels to maximum across the board. Don't, you know, buy into the, oh, you know, greens and reds are going to grow more algae. Don't buy into that stuff. Crank those color spectrums up. Get all of those diodes that you paid for rolling. And give the corals as much light across the board as you can. I think that right now where we're at in the reef industry, that's going to be, especially with LED lights, I think that's going to be the way to go, is to go color channels max across the board. And from there, just adjust your intensity so that you're not going too low and so you're not cooking your coral. And by the way, I run mine for SPS on top of the reef. It's like between 400 and 450. And then I kind of just, like, let the numbers fall where they will as you go down the rock work, of course. Like, there's no way for me to control that other than height of coral placement. So it's like 200 on the bottom, I think, I'm pretty sure, in my tank. And everything's happy. So that's lighting for me. I stay away from the big fancy, you know, I did the whole big name, big brand name, fancy lights, hype lights. I did all that, and I'm done with that. I have, over the nano tank, I got a, what are they called? Oh, I can't even remember the name. It's a Chinese black box light. Nikru Hyper Reef. It's fine. I think all the hype around lighting needs to, people need to chill with hype lighting. Let's see. Sump. I'm a low flow sump guy. I mean, that could change in the future if I do different things with my sump. If I put sponges in my sump, I'd probably bump it up. But right now, things are pretty simple. I have a GFO reactor. I run a little bit of GFO to keep phosphate down. I put a scoop of activated carbon in there, like a tablespoon of activated carbon. I just mix it in with the GFO. I do a skimmer. Like, I have a budget skimmer right now. That's one thing I'm looking at for, like, next 6 months. I want to get a skimmer that I have to service less, because it's becoming a little much. I've got a Bubble Magus skimmer. It works great, but it needs servicing every 3 months. That's a little much for my taste. I'd love to clean my skimmer out only, like, a couple times a year. That'd be nice. But that's basically it, along with sensors, and I'm running filter socks. I went back to filter socks. I'm finding them hard to beat. I don't want to take on all the work of, like, cutting out pieces of my sump to fit a filter roller. Also, filter rollers are really bulky. Also, filter rollers are a subscription plan. You're buying filter roll, and if I have one more subscription plan in my life, I'm going to lose it. I'm so tired of the subscription plan life. It is so annoying to me. So right now, throw in a couple filter socks in the washing machine with a hit of bleach every couple days. That's not so much work for me. And I have found a positive correlation going back to filter socks with my ORP. My ORP has gone up from that. And so I think that it's likely that my DOC situation in my tank has improved because filter socks are just reliable. So I'm down with filter socks right now. That's probably I don't really see that changing. Very happy with it. I have backup everything. I mentioned it earlier. I think backup heater. I've got a backup pump. Return pump. I've got backup sensors. You got a secondary thermometer in there, temperature sensor. I have backup everything, and I think backup everything is critically important. I've got an EcoFlow River 2 Max that's connected to my primary return pump. In the case of a power outage, I'm going to have, sump flow and current moving through my display tank. I think that's really important. I'm skimming over some things now, you can tell. Trust me, I've gone into all this at depth before. Just kind of trying to give you a holistic view and not really leave out any main factors here. Big change I recently made was the salt that I was using. So, I guess it's debatable whether it's a big change. There are people who are like, that doesn't matter. Like, salt. And I subscribe to the thought that the best salt is the salt that is right for you. So, right for you within your budgetary constraints, right for you within the parameters of alkalinity, calcium, magnesium, trace that's in the salt that you're desiring. I think yes. Also every system is different. So some people are going to have crazy high ORP, and going with a more cost-effective salt that is potentially not as quote unquote clean is not going to be a big problem for them. They might be doing way bigger water changes than me. Who knows? There's a million situations, but I do 15 gallons worth of water change every week, which is not huge. It's not small. It's not huge. I do an auto water change with a Neptune dose every night. And I switched over to Julian Sprung's Accuracy One from his company, Two Little Fishies. And I have seen a significant ORP boost from this, indicating again DOC is improved because of it. So I have improved my DOC or my ORP by 40 points from switching from Aquaforest Reef Salt, which is $60 for 200 gallons when it's on sale, over to Julian Sprung's, which is I think $100 for a or $95 or $100 for a 200 gallon box. So definitely more expensive, definitely. But also, that's pretty much the only thing that changed. The filter socks had settled in by the time I switched over that salt, even though I went back to filter socks, some weeks before. So I think, and again, I can't do all the official testing channels on all of it until my new income level kicks in here in September. I wish I'd had that available at the time, so I could have gotten some interesting numbers back on making this switch. But it certainly seems like some salt brands are quote unquote cleaner than others. That's what I'll say. I'm not going to sit here and say they're better, because it wouldn't be better for everyone. It might be financially way worse for someone else, but it's worth it for me given the fact that I do a fairly conservative water change every night. This is a better situation for me. I desire my salt mix to, improve ORP, to improve the DOC situation in my tank, right? So that's what I'm rolling with. I'm sticking with it. I like it. Let's see. Oh, carbon dosing. I try not to dose additional carbon to the tank. So let's just talk about dosing. You're putting carbon in your tank all the time anyway. You're feeding the tank, and carbon gets in your tank, and there's plenty of it. So I'm trying not to add carbon dosing to the tank. And by carbon dosing, I mean stuff like I'm not putting amino acids in my tank anymore. I'm not putting extra additives in the tank that are going to bump carbon, with one exception. And I've been criticized for this, and by the way, the criticism is fair. I have started dosing a very, very small amount of ammonia to my tank because ammonia is directly uptaken by corals. The kind of the ammonia mix, what I used is Baker's ammonia. So Baker's ammonia is technically a carbon source. It's sodium bicarbonate, I think it's called. Carbonate, right? So that is a fair criticism that, like, it's fair criticism on two levels. One, it's ammonia. People are very nervous about ammonia. There's not a ton of research out there on ammonia. Guys like Andrew Bauma have, you know, fully dived in on ammonia and have been extremely happy with it and found great results with it. Some of the old school guys have been doing it for a long time, and some of the scientific members of the general community are picking it up. And I think that Andrew told me that he was dosing. I think he notched it back a little bit, but I think he was dosing something like, you know, I'm not even going to say because I can't remember exactly what it was. I'll tell you this. It's way more than what I'm dosing. I'm literally dosing 0.2 milliliters per day of ammonia solution. It is extremely small. And I had an open dosing head. Some more scientifically minded people in this hobby have looked into ammonia dosing and expounded upon it. And I was like, well, I've got this available dosing head. I rarely try like really interesting new things, especially with dosing. So I was like, you know what? I'm just going to try this. Like I'm not immune to trying something new. You know, even if it is not like some widespread, you know, thing that is mainstream in the hobby right now, I decided to try it. And I'm trying it. I'm watching it. I'm keeping an eye on things. I've got ammonia tests. I'm keeping an eye on this, but it's interesting to me that what people have found who have really been looking into it. So I've got that going on. Other than that, Kelkwasser, and then I'm literally Bulk Reefs, because I have so many chemicals stockpiled from Bulk Reef Supply, still using Bulk Reef Supply, alkalinity, calcium, magnesium. I just have sacks of this stuff. So it'll be a long time before I exhaust those. I will look for alternative sources once those are exhausted. I want to stop sinking money into Aperture's, you know, just shoveling cash down their gullet. So I'm not getting any more supplementation from them. But that's basically it. Is like, I mean, and I'll say this, like Kelkwasser, the amount that I put into my tank takes care of like 90% of the needs of my corals where they currently stand. I do a minimal amount of traditional two-part alkalinity, calcium, magnesium, and that's because I don't really need that much of it. I just need to tweak. That's how I tweak my levels, is by tweaking the two-part dosing. So, and I tweak all that with a combination of my own water testing to verify my Neptune Trident, and then relying on the day-to-day, you know, multiple tests that the Trident gives me. And I am a automation guy. I don't think everything should be automated. I think you should always be checking the numbers that you are shown by your automation. So I verify and do my own testing weekly. And at the very worst, if I'm like crazy busy or away, I will like skip a weekend and then do it immediately when I get back. But I'm always verifying, because who knows? Who knows? Sometimes when those containers get low on like Trident reagents, you know, it can get a little weird and you start swinging a little bit on the spectrum, you know, what the numbers that it's giving you. So proceed with caution. But I believe that automation can really, like, for the vast majority of people who are, like, reef keepers who have a full-time job, who have family commitments, who might be out of town here and there, I think automation can really save your rear end. I really do. I think for most people, slightly more automation is usually given, you know, as long as you can do it effectively, right? As long as you understand your controller very well, I think slightly more automation is going to yield better results and more stability over time. It's not always the case. Again, that's a very individual thing. Some people are just not tech savvy in that way. Some people end up having a lot of bad luck with controllers or have had trauma with controllers and they're never going to be able to trust them again. I get it. I just think that in general, trending toward the more automation is going to yield a lot of people more stability. And I've got a full Neptune Apex system, minimal problems with it. Not a big fan of what Aperture's done with Neptune. Wasn't a big fan of certain things that Neptune did when Neptune was still Neptune and they weren't just a puppet for Aperture. But I tend to be very interested in controllers. I have bought some components for a Hydros controller that I'm going to be hooking up to one of my two nano tanks. And the other tank, this is the first I'm announcing of this to my general people who follow me. The other thing that I've already purchased, I got during the last days of BRS fire sales. I bought for, I think it was $285, a entry level GHL set, which I haven't even opened the box. I haven't had time. It's waiting. So I'm assembling bits and pieces of Hydros gear that I know I haven't bought a brain unit yet, but I'm going to. But I want to have one nano on GHL, one nano on Hydros, and one nano that's on, or not nano, my main tank on Neptune, because I have so much invested in Neptune gear. There's no way I'm changing this main tank. But I want to be able to learn the three primary controller systems that we have available to us here in America. I think it's important because I'm so gear driven. And I'm, by the way, I just love it anyway. So I'm super curious about it, about all three of them and how they compare. So I'm going to be doing that. I mean, that might be a next summer project for all I know. We'll see. I'd love to get into it this winter, but I don't know. I don't know if I'll have time. But it's there and it'll happen. Trying to think of, by the way, it should just be outright stated. I totally believe in water changes. I don't understand the whole no water change crowd. I don't get it. The whole fight to justify and create this whole line of rhetoric that is like, you don't need water changes. If you just do all of this right, if you just, you know, send in tests all the time and, you know, blah, 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 I don't get it. Just do your water changes. Just change the water. I don't get it. It, to me, I know this is going to be a harsh, this is going to sound harsh, but like, to me, all those efforts to push for this whole way of doing things that is the no water change route, that's all a fancy excuse for like being lazy. Like, just do your water changes. And this is for the majority of people. I'm sure that there are very intelligent people who have, you know, found some very niche way of doing things where they're like, oh, this is, I have deduced that like, this is absolutely based on all these special ways I'm running my tank. This is the best way to do it is no water changes. I think for most reef keepers, that is, you are walking a knife's edge. It doesn't even have to be that much. Like I just said, I've got a 110 gallon reef system. I do a 15 gallons worth of water change every week. It doesn't have to be crazy. I just think that you should be at some point taking out some of the water that's been in your tank forever and replacing it with some fresh, not fresh water, but fresh salt water. You see what I'm saying? I don't see how it could be bad. Provided you know how to mix salt and test the salinity properly, I don't see how it could be bad. And when it comes to salinity, I test my salinity twice a week, once in the middle of the week, once when I do my weekly maintenance on the weekends, because I think that that is also, I calibrate my refractometer every single week because I think salinity is the one parameter that is likely the most important. And I think it's the one that people sleep on the most for sure. I think people sleep on salinity. I think they sleep on calibrating their test equipment for salinity. And I think that a lot of problems in this hobby likely arise from people sleeping on salinity. I think it's really critically important to be testing that and be testing in general. That's another thing I don't get is people who are like, ah, testing, whatever. I test once a month. I've never tested. I test every 3 months. Testing's BS. Everybody talks about it. Just do water changes. You don't need to test. You're just trusting that every time the salt mix is going to be right? Like, again, I don't get it. I am obsessive about making sure everything is right where it should be. And for some people, maybe that would ruin the hobby. I know, you know, like Telegram. Really respect Telegram. And his methodology is very attractive to me in many ways. We do things differently, but like the way that that he does things to me is very respectable. I know he's gone through periods where he's not like militant testing. If you have the experience and the trust in what you're using, like I fully anticipate that guy has reefing knowledge such that he can keep a handle on things, and watching his tank, he would know when things were starting to slide and could take corrective action and begin testing. If he wants to, you know, not test so much, he's put in the time, effort, and, you know, has that knowledge to kind of like keep a handle on that. I don't think most people, and by the way, I'm including myself in this, I don't think most reef keepers have that. I don't think that they should be trusting themselves to just subscribe to a methodology where they're not regularly testing. You should be testing your reef tank at minimum once a week and adjusting dosing accordingly. You really should. There's no excuse to be doing it less than that for the vast majority of reef keepers, again, in my unesteemed opinion. But I test all my levels every day, and I test phosphate every other day because my phosphate, I really pay attention to. I'm kind of obsessive about it. And I test nitrate once a week. So like, it's never gone up very high, but I test it once a week anyway. Because who knows? I'm sure Julian Sprung and Two Little Fishies and Accuracy One are that's a pretty trustworthy thing to be putting in my tank and cranking through every week. But who's to say? Who's to say that, you know, some weird thing doesn't happen in the facility one day and somebody doesn't notice it and it just gets, you know, some of it just gets packaged up and shipped out. I would not put that much trust in anybody to get the products right every single time that you could just sit there and say, testing's not important. I think testing's important. So, again, all within someone's experience range and, you know, their ability to look at their tank and understand that something might be off, which most people don't have, especially newer reef keepers. But I'm putting the work into the numbers and verifying the numbers and keeping a tight handle on this, because I think that in the end, it's going to yield more stability. And that's really, if I were to boil my whole ethos down, everything that I do from backup power to backup alternate, like, you know, return pumps and heaters and, you know, the militant maintenance and the triple checking of, you know, the levels of alkalinity and calcium and, you know, nitrate, phosphate, all this stuff that goes into my tank. Like everything, you know, how extensive my controller system is, everything for me is all in the service of seeking more stability in the tank. How can I get this thing more stable? How can I maximize the stability so that, you know, when one thing goes wrong or fails, the one weekend I'm out of town, you know, my wife's not scrambling, freaking out while she's got a kid hanging off of her and she's alone here and something's sliding sideways. How do I mitigate all the eventualities that could come to pass if I don't do my homework and if I don't stay militant about this stuff? Like, how do I... And the answer is just do the homework. If you need to not buy coral, you need to not buy more cool frags so that you can buy a backup heater, buy the backup heater. Play it conservative. I play it pretty conservative. Doing 0.2 milliliters of ammonia dosing to my tank is like the most unconservative thing that I maybe have ever done in like my modern era of reef keeping, like the last 3 years. That's probably like the craziest thing that I've done. So yeah, I am of the mindset that, you know, generally you should try to eliminate variables, seek stability, and play it conservative, and success will follow. At the very least, stability will follow. And if you're not seeing the growth success that you're wanting out of your animals, then that can be dealt with after the stability is achieved. But stability first, then growth. A lot of people go in and they're like, growth, growth, growth. Growth only. Like, that's my one drive. I just want to grow crazy coral. It's like, okay, I understand. I do too. I want coral that I'm chopping back because it's, you know, growing up too close to the surface. I get that. I get that want. I get that drive. But not at the expense of one little thing goes wrong while you're out of town for 2 days and you're putting your marriage on the rocks because your wife has to run around and try to rescue the tank and she can't because there's too many variables and then everything's failing. It's not worth it. Cover your bases first. That's generally my methodology. Cover your bases. Seek stability. Yeah, I'm trying to think of really anything else major. I think I've covered the major categories behind it. I don't feed any kind of coral foods to the tank. No way in hell I'm putting a one drop of Allen's concoction in this tank. No, I'm not putting anything in here other than, and this is me because I live in rural America. And I don't want to pay shipping costs over and over again for frozen food. I don't feed frozen. I feed pellet food from Hikari, which is reputable. I've consulted some people on it. And I feed Seaweed Extreme algae pellets. And I feed carnivore, Hikari carnivore pellets. Both are like medium-sized pellet, I think. Not very big, but not too small either. And I feed pretty heavy. I feed two rolls on like the second setting on a Neptune auto feeder, which is a decent roll. Two rolls of carnivore and two rolls of Seaweed Extreme every day. You guys see the fish. I have no fish aggression. The fish are fat. The fish are happy. If anything, I wish they'd eat a little bit more, you know, sprigs of algae that pop up on the rockwork. Because they're not really hungry for it, because they get plenty. And they seem to be in great health. So I think that from where I sit, you know, Hikari seems pretty reputable. And I've had people who know way more about fish food echo that for me. Like, if you're going to do a pellet, you know, Hikari is one of the safe ones to use. You know, they've done their homework on it. So that has worked out well for me so far. And if I get evidence to the contrary, I would shift and do something else. But, you know, the PetSmart in my town, there's one pet store. It's PetSmart, which PetSmart's way worse than Petco. There's bad ones. There's bad branches of both. But PetSmart is way more limited than like a Petco. They have no saltwater anything, and they are not carrying hardly any frozen food. Like, it's like, you know, bloodworms and stuff. Like, I just, no, like, I'm not going to do that. So, no, this has worked out. It's worked out really well just feeding the pellets. And I know that the corals are picking up bits of pellet dust and stuff anyway. And that seems to be plenty on the feeding front. So, yeah, I can't think of anything else, guys. I'm sure I could go over my backup cooling system, you know, every little fail safe that I have, how I've wire management. I've got just thoughts on all this, deep thoughts on so many things in this hobby. I'll save some of it. I'll do some of this in later episodes. I'll have a boring episode about like wire management and arrangement of technology and controller boxes. If you guys want stuff like that, I'll bring it to you. I'll just keep cranking out. I could talk about it all day. My wife, literally, when I get rolling, she's like ready to put her head through a wall. She's like, go make a podcast. Seriously, I can't take it. Like, It's just all she hears about. So I appreciate you guys listening. If you were interested this far, I really do. That's a lot of the long and the short of my broad methodology, like how I'm doing things in reef keeping. And yeah, I can expand on more of it later. And I'll go over like all the little changes that I made in depth in a future episode, I guess. Even though I intended to do that in this episode, there's no way. I'm going to cap this thing. But I hope you guys have a great week. Again, I'm going to Reefstock, so I will be back with like a, you know, Reefstock in review episode after. You know, it might be a couple weeks before I can do it because the beginning of the semester gets pretty wild. But yeah, I'm glad that I got to do this today. Have a great one, guys. Take it easy.